We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And today we are looking at the... I don't even know where this fits in the category, but this is the sort of first real animated Doctor Who episode, Scream of the Shaka, starring Richard E. Grant as the doctor. A strange meteor crashes on the Earth, incapacitating the two people who have strangely decided to run up to it and poke at the worm that's coming out of it. They are harmed in some way. The Time Lords direct the Doctor to a small town in England, which for 3 weeks has been sitting quietly in terror of something underneath the ground. The Doctor discovers that the Shaka, a dominating race living on volcanic gas, has inhabited the planet underneath and are planning some form an invasion. While the Doctor works through his personal crises about companionship and being an island and being a nice guy, the Doctor and the military slowly resolve the problem of the Scream of the Shaka. Which just shows I didn't actually write a summary and did it kind of on the fly. So this is... unlike the previous two animated adventures...
Three.
Oh, right. I keep forgetting Shada, right? Sorry. Unlike the previous three, this one has really reached the stage where I would call it an animated feature.
And, yes. And, I mean, this is a whole different category, in effect, I think.
Yeah, so it's sort of the first, but it's sort of the fourth, but it's... and it's got, you know, it's got names.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what exactly you would describe the other ones as, because they are animation in the sense of you have moving pictures, but very, very crude movements. Here you've got Cosgrove Hall and you have proper, you know, it's a proper cartoon.
In the documentary that associates this with regards to the history of animation on BBC, they talk about, for example, Death Comes to Time, where they had a radio play, and then somebody drew some pictures, and their exact wording was, and I wish I had written this down, so it's their virtually exact wording was, they supplied some pictures, which they put on the screen, and moved around a little bit.
Yes.
which is kind of
where it's come from, and it's not as if animation had not reached a stage of development in 2001 when I think the first bit of Death Comes to Time went out, that it wasn't vastly, vastly more sophisticated than that. The problem was, how do you get it down people's telephone lines, where, you know, in a pre-broadband era when everyone's relying on real player and 56 kilobits a second is considered
at the
to
most,
be high speed.
Yeah. It's this is a whole different animal.
Yes.
But it was still broadcast on the web, broadcasting.
Yes. Webcast.
Do you know if it was released all at once, or was it released 1 week at a time, or I didn't get that out of the documentary.
I don't remember, but I think it was episodic. I think they've all been episodic in a way. It's one, obviously they have all been episodic in the construction of it, but in the release as well. Clearly, the Death Comes to Time thing, where they had episodes, but within those episodes they had chapters, and the chapters were released gradually, is the most kind of complicated iteration of that. But all of them reflect the kind of, for want of a better word, classic Who structure of having a serial, you know, with a cliffhanger, and you have to wait till next week to find out what happens. So even though I thought there were quite a lot of things in Shaka that a couple of years before the show came back on television did kind of reflect a slightly more modern way of doing things, that certainly was still that was old style.
It's still funny that I would guess that if I had known about this 5 years ago, that question would never have occurred to me. Obviously, it was released, you know, over time because it's in episodic form. But in this era where Netflix makes a TV series on their own and then just dumps the whole thing on the same day, you know, that's called into question. But yeah, I think of its time, nobody had thought of that.
Yeah, Wikipedia has it being broadcast over 6 weeks. So it was definitely released in that way.
And it was meant to be a series originally. I mean, not a series of six episodes, but a series of multiple Doctor Who stories for the 40th anniversary, the forgotten anniversary of Doctor
Yes.
Who.
Yes. Well, yes. I mean, it's not just a kind of continuation of these sort of varied but still successful for BBCI or whatever it was. This thing of using Doctor Who as a way of bringing people into the site and gaining interest in online, you know, there was that, but there was I think some more ambition around this one, in the sense of it's been 40 years. Doctor Who isn't back for real.
No, it's not coming back, according to the BBC. No way,
and it's
no
not
how.
Coming back. Yeah, as they thought at the time. It's not coming back. Let's bring it back. Let's do this. And I don't know. There's a lot of enthusiasm gone into this, hasn't there, from a lot of well-intentioned people who really did seem, with their actions, when you look at them in retrospect, to be digging a hole in which to bury it.
Yes, it is. And I'll say right now, we stand a really good chance of deflecting this conversation away from Scream of the Shaka and to the tale of the production of Scream of the Shaka. So I before we get too far into it, because I actually think it's far more interesting, the story behind it was far more interesting than the story itself. So let's talk about the story as presented, and then devolve into why it is what it is. All of this information is on the DVD release as well. There's documentaries on there that talk about the production, and really they were more riveting to me than Scream of the Shaka, which is not to say that I hated Scream of the Shaka, but it was.
But you can say that now. if we're getting onto that,
I didn't hate it, actually. I can't say I liked it, but I'd take it over Happiness Patrol or Delton the Bannerman any day. I really would.
Okay, that's interesting. Because I mean, that was my attitude towards Death Comes to Time. It wasn't the greatest thing ever, but there were episodes of Doctor Who that had gone out on the telly that I thought were considerably worse. I liked Scream of the Shaka. I would say I liked it, but not wholeheartedly.
Right.
Because I think there were some extremely odd decisions that clearly held it back, in the sense of this could have been a lot better. And I mean, that's partly what I mean by some well-meaning people kind of gathering around trying to do something good for the show, but by virtue of what they did, they actually created this kind of cul-de-sac in the show's
timeline
and continuity, in which this kind of oddball offshoot gets shoved, when actually they could have done something I would have thought that was a reasonably decent continuation of the show, and which would have stood up better in retrospect if they hadn't done some of these things.
Mm.
And in particular, recasting the Doctor.
I mean, Richard E. Grant, yes. We have to start and end here with Richard E. Grant.
Who I'm going to say I liked as the Doctor, eventually.
I mean, he gets
less time at this than Paul McGann did in the TV movie, because you add all this up and it's six 10 to 15 minute episodes, including all of the kind of recaps and theme
not much
tune
in the way of
bits.
Those, though. They're pretty stingy on the recaps.
Well, given you've got a 10-minute episode, I think.
But you know, in the classic Doctor Who formula, if they're recreating it, there were episodes where there was no recap at all. If not all of the episodes, there was no recap. You just went right to the next scene, which kind of makes sense because you could just watch it on the web yourself. It's not like you had to remember it from last week, but it gave me the opportunity that when we rolled the credits, I thought, oh, I have time to get up and grab something out of the kitchen, and then didn't. Because, you know, because there'll be a little bit of a recap there, so I'll just, it fell with my Doctor Who viewing mentality because of that. But
Richard E. Grant gets very little time to warm up into the role, and also he gets written as this very kind of, and you know, this is another of these decisions that I think, in a way you can kind of say, oh, well, that's a bit forward-looking, oh, it's a bit like what they did in the kind of revival, which, I mean, obviously some people hate it, but has been hugely successful and I think is overall pretty brilliant. All this stuff about, you know, the baggage of the last Time Lord, the Lonely Time Lord stuff, you know, giving him that additional backstory. And you've got something like that in the sense of at the beginning of this, you've got the Doctor who has, we don't learn exactly how,
but
obviously lost a companion and has become this lonely traveller, and over the course of the serial is supposed to kind of warm up. But the problem is that you have two episodes of really just not liking the character at all, and it seems to me a pretty decision that doesn't serve someone who's trying to establish themselves in the role very well at all.
It would have served him better if it had been another few stories where the companion who, and I kid you not, I've forgotten her name already.
Allison,
there we go. And I've watched this less than an hour ago. It's that bad. She is so utterly unmemorable. But the Doctor, obviously we were going to get filled in with backstory if they'd made more episodes, which, if you have the commitment for more episodes, is one way to tell a story. But if you don't have the commitment to do that, it's an annoying choice.
But I don't mind the ambition of saying, you know, let's create a bit of backstory, let's create some mystery to the character that allows to explore. The show's tried to do that as well, on some occasions more successfully than others. But okay, I can live with that. What I think is a poor choice is giving us a Doctor who we can't readily identify. Well, not just we can't identify with him, but actually that we have no one with whom we can identify, because the Doctor is pretty much the lead character in this, at least when you look at Rose, which was broadcast only a couple of years later. You get Rose as the identifier character. That's your way into the story. Plus you get the you know, standing on the skin of the planet, feeling it spinning through space speech.
So that is purely, I'm going to say it, that is purely the competency and, I won't say brilliance, but in other words, it's the extreme competency of Russell T. Davies as a writer over Paul Cornell.
Paul Cornell is a good writer.
But he wasn't up to this. He was too into the Doctor Who mode. The Doctor's already the hero. We're working. Everything's established. You should know the Doctor's the hero. You should follow him. And Russell T. Davies was able to stand back from that and say, nope, I got to start with the audience again.
Russell T. Davies is incredible. I think over and above his skills as a writer, because I think he's an incredibly good writer as well, but he has this eye for populism and for creating something out of nothing. Of course, Doctor Who wasn't nothing, but other shows he has done it. And I think that's a fairly unique skill. I think it's harsh to criticise Paul Cornell for doing that, for not being able to do that with the kind of skill that someone like RTD and the BBC team that brought the show back did. But I also have picked up from the documentary the fact that some of the terrible decisions about, like the decision to have the doctor going on this journey wasn't from Paul Cornell's story. It was one of the producers they brought in on the series said, well, let's do this. And another of the producers said, we need something from the old show, which explains another of the unimaginably terrible decisions. Well, it's not unmitigatedly terrible, but still, let's have an android master in the TARDIS.
Yeah, I don't... Yeah, okay. Well, okay, so let's hit Richard Grant, because he goes on this hero's journey from unlikable and withdrawn and remote, but, you know, not so much that when the Time Lords land him there, he's screaming, I'm not going to do it. I mean, how many times has Tom Baker done that? That's not out of character. Halfway through, he uses the phrase, I've got my groove back. And we're supposed to follow then that he is now back to, you know, planet-saving, doctor-y guy who's the hero, and he's... But here's the thing. Richard E. Grant is fine, and I could see him playing the doctor, and yeah. I don't have any problem with that. I think that it's an unmitigated disaster doing it in animated form, because if Matt Smith is flapping his arms and his face is wobbling like rubber while he's screaming crazy lines, the actor sells it with it because he is actually doing weirdy things. But stiff animated Richard E. Grant shouting, come get me big boy or whatever it is, doesn't work. It just does not, the animation and the character don't fit. And
I do think you have a point there.
I'm not getting Richard E. Grant out of this. I'm getting a voiceover, and therefore Richard E. Grant never inhabits this role for me from the beginning to the end. He just doesn't. He sounds like a guy reading lines over it, and I know he's putting acting in there and he's doing okay, but it just, because it jars with the images, and he doesn't look like Richard Grant either. It looks like a vampire.
Okay. I'm going to say, because we kind of said about the animation, this is Cosgrove Hall, and it's a different class of animation, and it is really, really good. The one criticism I have of it is I don't like the way the Doctor is drawn. Most of it, I think, it is brilliant, and there's kind of sufficient expression and detail, and the quality of the movements and everything is really, you know, as good as you might hope for. But I didn't particularly care for the way the Doctor is drawn. But I do. I think you've hit on something by saying that actually what you see on screen then in terms of what the limitations of the animation are, and that's not really a criticism of the animation. It's the nature of the beast. That does take something away, because I don't think Richard E. Grant's performance felt to me like he was reading. I think if you shut your eyes and listened to some of the lines, that works well for me. But when you look at the animation, as you say, it jars with it, and that obviously detracts, because then you've got the two things working in opposite directions. And the problem with this one, because it is, it has stepped forward enormously in terms of the animation, is the audio is no longer enough on its own.
Mm-hmm.
The audio has become an audio soundtrack to a visual show, and you can't just shut off the visuals anymore and expect the audio to carry it in the way that the other webcasts have done, because that's the way in which they've been produced. And actually, because they've been produced by people who really know audio. And, you know, in this one, while the audio was fine, and so there was some kind of quite distinctive sounds produced, overall I didn't think the sound design was as accomplished as the previous ones.
Oh, there was a point there where one of the producers did say something to the effect of, we reached the point where we wish it had a Big Finish back.
Well, as did Big Finish.
Yeah.
I mean, it does make a bit more sense, the fact that they kind of broke with what had been quite a successful partnership in producing Real Time and Sharda to do this thing that they thought they were going to be able to spin out a whole series. So they were trying to build the production capacity in-house, and it kind of makes sense, even if it still looks like a wrong-headed decision. But the other thing about Richard E. Grant, I mean, so as you say, he gets to this point where he kind of says, I've got my groove back, and you feel that he's arrived. But that is supposed to have come about as a result of this. He's been in this dark place because something terrible has happened, yada, yada, yada. We're used to that happening because he's regenerated, and we're expecting to find the Doctor that we know him. But we don't get any kind of regeneration continuity in that one. We get a reference to the fact that Andy Warhol wanted to paint all nine of him. So as far as Schalker is concerned, this is the ninth
the War Doctor.
Well, yes. When Rose comes along, and it's established the ninth Doctor, and of course everyone accepts that, because only a crazy, crazy person would try to fit in another Doctor between the eighth and the ninth. We all know that's nonsense.
Yes, yes. Or just replace the ninth altogether with a different one.
Yes.
Wishful thinking. All right. Doctor. Let's put it that way.
I'm not going to get into that, but I think that it's an odd decision to recast the Doctor at all. So never mind Richard E. Grant, who I think, you know, could have been fine. Why recast the Doctor at all? Because I think if you hadn't recast the Doctor, what would the consequences have been? Well, looking back on it now, you'd have eight Doctor stories in a gap where there is a dearth, at least, of on-screen Eighth Doctor stories, so big tick.
Assuming that they'd gone with the Eighth Doctor.
Well, yeah, but looking at it at the time, what they wanted to do was make new Doctor Who stories that took the story forward, that were genuinely a kind of a proper new series. Paul McGann was the Doctor at this point. Why wouldn't they have gone with Paul McGann? They'd had Paul McGann making Sharda the year before. Okay, real time was an oddity in the or a kind of different tack, in the sense that they were going for really, I suppose, pleasing the kind of hardcore fans by stepping back into the show's continuity and adding extra shows in there, but not renewing the show and creating something that was genuinely intended to appeal to new audiences. But I don't see why you couldn't do that with the Eighth Doctor and McGann. I mean, the reason that, so, you know, a few years before this, Big Finish got the license to make audio Doctor Who stories. They got together the kind of writers who were making Doctor Who stories, albeit at that point by writing novels about it, Paul Cornell included. And one of those left the meeting when he discovered that Paul McGann wasn't involved. Famously, Stephen Moffat thought that it would not work to stick stories back into the show's past. But what he was saying was, we need to make new Doctor Who that is going forwards. But he wanted Paul McGann. The way to do it.
Well, then why didn't he come back when they got Paul McGann?
Well, he has recanted, so his position now has been, well, I was wrong about that. But even he, the kind of the sternest critic of this approach of inserting stories into the Doctor's past, saw the way that new Doctor Who could be made was to take Paul McGann as the current Doctor and to take that story forward. And, you know, and when Paul McGann did start doing Big Finish stories, those stories were the most cutting edge stories. Big Finish treated them differently. They made them into seasons. And you didn't quite know where he would go, because you didn't know where that story ended. And that made some sense to me. So I don't see why, you know, if the BBC webcast people, BBCI people, were thinking, what we want to do is make new Doctor Who, and in order to do that, we need to have the latest story, the ongoing story. Why does that have to be a new Doctor? I mean, even having the new Doctor, it presupposes at some point that Paul McGann is regenerated into Richard E. Grant.
Yeah.
But why not just pick it up just before that?
How about this as a solution? There is also another documentary on the DVD disc that is Interweb of Fear, which is about the history of kind of the BBC website, but also the history of Doctor Who on the BBC website. And strangely enough, once they're past Death Comes to Time, they kind of ignore the other two completely. But and there's nothing at all about why they split with Big Finish after two successful stories. So, but let's say this was not necessarily a business decision split. This was a personality split. If that's the case, they may not have been in a position to use Paul McGann. He may have had a contract with Big Finish. They may not wanted to have supported Big Finish. They may wanted to have to make a clean break with the Big Finish doctor. There's nothing about that in any of these documentaries at all. It's like why they aren't. Well, they did that, but.
Yes, but I mean, but also you could remember that Big Finish for all the fact that I think it is wonderful, and you know, I said how much I think their Doctor Who is the best Doctor Who out there. It's just a subsidiary. It's subservient to the BBC's use of it, but BBC licenses it to them, unless Paul McGann himself was so offended by the whatever schism, you know, caused them to go their separate ways, which I suspect, you know, there's nothing to suggest it really was a personality thing so much as the BBC just suddenly deciding they wanted to bring it in-house. I mean, you know, Gary Russell was unhappy with that, but would Paul McGann have been,
I don't know,
in a position to say, kind of turn down the work?
But these things are so politically charged, it may just have been. Well, and the other,
I don't know. I mean, to me, that's pure speculation.
Oh yeah.
I mean, equally, you could say maybe they wanted to, because it was their thing. They wanted to attach a big name to it. We know they thought they might get Robbie Williams at one time. So,
okay, so Robbie Williams, he's this big name. He's very famous over there. What is he? He's a singer, isn't he?
He's a singer. Yeah.
Okay.
Apparently, and. I can see, you know,
commentary noted.
attaching a really big name to the part, though it might have been a disaster in creative terms, would have been a huge coup in publicity terms in terms of generating a new audience for the show.
Unless they locked another reporter in a cupboard.
they didn't do well on the publicity. What with locking up the press, but Richard E. Grant as an actor, okay, you know, is a well known name
and has played the Doctor before.
Has he?
He did in the Red Nose special with Rowan Atkinson.
Oh God, yes, yeah, Stephen Moffat's Yes, okay. But Paul McGann had played the Doctor before, and my point is going to be that you know, there is some parity. And since Paul McGann is also has a big name, Richard E. Grant, I would still have to say that, you know, he's got to be most famous for his breakthrough, right, in Withnell and I, in which he co-starred with Paul McGann. So, you know, and that was Paul McGann's breakthrough as well. So why Richard E. Grant should be a bigger name than Paul McGann is also a complete mystery to me. I cannot explain that.
More letters. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. It sort of kind of... The only thing I can make sense out of it is the idea you go back to that we were going to start making an entirely new series and they just wanted to kind of start freshy thing. But... that's it. And
yeah, I mean, you could level, I suppose, the same criticism that I'm leveling at Russell T. Davies's version of rebooting the show
a couple of years later. Yeah.
It's not Paul McGann, so, you know, don't like it. Whereas, actually,
I've always
wouldn't
thought,
have been correct.
I always thought Russell T. Davies was hedging his bets when he cast Chris Eccleston, not because of the quality of Chris Eccleston's acting, but I mean hedging his bets in terms of the story. Because if you go through the first I don't know, 2 seasons, maybe.
One.
At what point do we firmly establish that Chris Eccleston is not the first Doctor?
I don't know about that, but School Reunion is you know, that's the kind, okay, of...
School Reunion is the point when we finally know Tom Baker was really the Doctor. But if you play the first season, and I did, or first season Chris Eccleston through, there's nothing in that that says any of previous history happened. It could be a complete reboot. He could be the first Doctor, the second Doctor out of the gate. And yes, he's from Gallifrey. Yes, he's wiped out the Time Lords and all that stuff. But he could have jettisoned any of the continuity he wanted to at any time until School Reunion. And then,
yeah, well, I mean, I think you're right. Even in Dalek, there's nothing. But the point is, there's nothing there that needs to be explained to a new audience. So what you're doing is you're treating the new audience and the old audience on an equal footing. I don't buy that he was hedging his bets. I think he was being clever in the sense of keeping a new audience on board without unnecessarily contradicting the continuity of the show. And I say unnecessarily partly because I don't think that should be what drives story choices, but also partly because the continuity of the show is already so mangled that you can't not contradict some of it.
I love continuity, but it is without a doubt an albatross around its neck at times. Yes. There's no doubt about that. Somebody should straighten that out and get it straightened out and then never break it again. That's the correct approach. I can just break it whenever I want. let's do some improved storytelling techniques and say we're going to establish a continuity and then we're going to stick to it from now on.
Okay. Like a kind of unremovable albatross.
Yes.
So, yeah, I think that had this been successful, maybe the kind of criticism of regenerating the Doctor would seem churlish and unwell founded in the same way that's kind of arguing that Christopher Eccleston should have been Paul McGann would.
Okay, so how about and I can't even figure out what the heck's going on there, but what is with the Android Master?
Well, so having one webcast where the Doctor has an Android as that he's built himself as his companion,
so he stops
maybe
being
regarded
hurt
as a misfortune. But having two webcasts where he has an Android that he's built himself as a companion looks like carelessness to me.
Okay, wait a second. Do we establish for a fact that he built that master Android?
Because the master Android says, "As you programmed my electronic brain."
He could have reprogrammed his electronic brain.
Well, all right, maybe. I think there's certainly nothing to contradict the fact that he's built his own master.
I think there's a little something in there. The first is when the master seems to try to hypnotize Allison. That's actually the second thing. The first thing is when he seems to throw in his lot with the Shaka. The second is when he tries to hypnotize Allison. And the third is when he says, "I made the mistake of accepting the sentence," or something like that. When the Doctor offered me this, and I made the choice as my punishment, I made the choice of accepting this. As if I'm wondering if this is, I'm going to say, the Master's personality transferred into a robot. But we have seen the Master make androids of himself before, and so the Doctor takes the continuing evil of the Master, reprograms him a bit so he's a good companion for him, but it's still the Master underneath. Why would he program him with all those evil instincts of the Master too much of the Master? I don't understand, to me,
all of those things were because he programmed him as the Master, so that was what he was supposed to do. And then up to some point, it'd be like Gann in Blake 7 having a limiter that stopped him from actually doing anything too terrible, but to me it's such an odd, and again it seems to have come out of the fact that, you know, it's not something you can blame Paul Cornell for. He turned in a story and then they got round like a committee and said, "Oh look, we need something old from the old show's continuity," and as we've just discussed, this isn't a mistake that Russell T. Davies would have made. made. We need something from the show's old continuity in order to appeal to that audience.
How about the hologram Peter Davison?
And the way we'll do it is we'll get the Master in, but because we want to please everyone, we will do it in such a way that having the Master in isn't a kind of overriding factor of the story. So we've got a proper new story, and we'll stick him in the TARDIS kind of virtual companion. And I just can't see anything you could do with the Master that would be more unsatisfying. It's such a terrible, terrible, disrespectful thing to do to that character.
It's weirdy. And you know what else is weird about it? I stand by my statement. I will say, you know, prior to Utopia, I have never heard of nor seen Derek Jacobi, never. Or if I had, he flew under the radar completely. But he stands, without doubt, for his 45 seconds as the Master, or whatever he played. He stands as the absolute best of the new series. He stands ahead of Anthony Ainley in the old series, and I could easily see him taking the mantle from Roger Delgado, although that is obviously the part that Delgado created, so that would be a tough call. But he is obvious. I mean, that I've said it before, that switch from nice guy to evil, and it's so believable. Both of them are so believable, that the pottery old nice guy, and then suddenly he's like, wow, that's the most evil being in the universe. Absolutely perfect. And then that's who's doing this part. And it's terrible.
Well, it's not. I mean, that's one of the things that I would agree with you. I think, I mean, much as I liked Michelle Gomez and I'm pleased to have her back, I thought Derek Jacobi's Master was fantastic. And it's totally unjust that we've had so little of it. And I would love to have more of it. And this does give us more of it, but
it's not the same.
It is disrespectful to the character that they have put him in a situation where he can do nothing to serve the story, and he's really limited in terms of where there is to go with that. That's no reflection on Jacobi. Jacobi's performance is wonderful. The interplay between Grant and Jacobi in this is great, like you say, the switching between evil and good, it comes across in this. Again, I really like it in this.
Really? And I see this as yet a third character from the other two. And this is just sort of vacillating Toadie. And I mean, not that he's incompetently playing vacillating Toadie, but it's just sort of, I don't know, it just doesn't. It doesn't gel for me. It just, like, first off, because there's no logical reason for him to be there, and nothing he does has any logical consequences.
Well, no, but I agree about that. But that is the problem with the story, and the character, and it is a real problem in this. But I don't think that the performance and something about the situation. So, okay, the reason, the logic for him being in that situation is completely shot. But this idea of forcing the Doctor and the Master together, I've just read Alistair Reynolds' Harvest of Time.
Oh, I'm only like in chapter two of that. It just came out the other day.
So. I'm not going to give any spoilers away. The Third Doctor story featuring the Master, in which I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say they have to
work together,
and travel together, and you get a lot of that kind of.
That's on the dust jacket, yeah.
Interplay, and I'm just trying to be careful here, but you know, the whole kind of.
But that's a trope from the Third Doctor era too.
Yeah, but not as extensively, and not long before that, I listened to Dark Eyes 3, the Big Finish, latest but one Big Finish Eighth Doctor story, which has the Doctor and the Master is the across kind of four
is
hours.
Is it Jeffrey Beavers?
I'm not telling you who it is because
it's obviously not Roger Delgado.
It constitutes a spoiler for another story if I tell you who's playing it. So any listeners who might not have listened to this other particular story, which I can't name for the same reason I can't name the actor who's playing the master in this one, basically just if you are worried about spoilers, just basically listen to everything Big Finish has made without looking at any of the covers and then come back and I'll tell you.
Thank you so much. That's terribly helpful.
but my point is, it's this very enjoyable situation where you have the doctor and the master constantly battling with this prisoner's dilemma kind of situation where there is some kind of mutual dependency and you never quite know when the trust or the truce is going to break. And had there been a real story justification for that, and had we had Richard E. Grant and Derek Jacobi playing that, then I would have really enjoyed it. But this just felt to me like a kind of a throwaway thing, and it's so inconsequential, and it's such a waste of Jacobi and the character of the Master.
Yep, they should have gone with a hologram Peter Davison.
Yes. Yep. When you say that having a hologram Peter Davison in your TARDIS is a better idea than something else, you kind of have to think, well, God, what on earth was the idea? But yeah, it would have been a better idea.
It's interesting that thinking that, right? So we have this kind of in the Three Doctors, where you have the First Doctor kind of come in and be giving advice because he's the older patrician, but really he's the younger. Hmm. He's the least experienced of the bunch.
Yeah.
In the Doctors. And I would be willing to bet that if they had a holographic Peter Davison, he would be like the older, wiser Doctor giving advice. And that would be wrong.
It would be totally wrong on
who would want very, their younger very, self telling them many, what to do.
Yeah, on very many levels, but it comes back to A, don't let committees write stories because this is a terrible way to cram in some past continuity into the show. And also, if you want continuity from the past, why didn't you have Paul McGann as the Doctor?
That's one way. They had the TARDIS in it, for crying out loud.
I did really, really, really like the design of the TARDIS with the spiral staircase. I thought that was fantastic looking, and that's one of the best TARDIS designs of all time in my book.
I like the round things. I don't know.
It had them too, but the spiral staircase, I'm thinking of the 11th Doctor's first TARDIS where, kind of stairs suddenly became a big feature in the console room. And to me, this is a much... If you're going to have stairs in the console room, well, basically I thought, don't have stairs in the console room. But actually, having seen this, I now think, yeah, stairs in the console room really rock if you do them like that.
So why have stairs in the console room? I mean, if you have a...
'Cause it looks cool.
That's got to be the only reason, because you've got a ship that can configure its own thing. You would think stairs would be a bad thing. Are there no Time Lords in wheelchairs? How's Davros or the Daleks going to get around inside the TARDIS?
I think the answer is in the question.
This is
Dalek proofing your TARDIS.
Disabled. We'll never have a wheelchair bound companion here, which is discriminatory. So you hear all the calls for everything else, but I haven't heard anybody yet companion in a wheelchair. That would add a whole new dimension to running up and down the corridors.
That would be good actually, but obviously they would
heal them within three episodes.
Yeah, no,
they would. Just like they always grow them magically to about 8 or 9 at the very least, so they don't have to work with babies on the set.
I think that is an interesting thing, because an area that they haven't gone, and it would be a really interesting and positive thing to do, but they would have to do it respectfully, and that would mean not kind of doing some kind of magical healing. But I don't think the TARDIS would be a problem, because obviously the TARDIS can automagically reconfigure itself to not have stairs in it, or at least have some kind of stair lift, or have the entrance on the level or something.
Oh, cool. One of those little seats that you ride on up the spiral stairs. I would go with that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
That would be fun. But, yeah. Anyway, what else have we got in this story? We've got our companion, Allison, who through...
Be the first black companion?
I guess officially so.
Because, you know, I seem to remember Martha being...
The credit for that, yeah.
I mean, obviously, she was the first one on TV. I don't know whether we count this as being on TV, but if we do... It's on screen of a sort. So, yeah, okay.
Liz Tan?
Sorry?
That's Liz Tan, isn't it? That actress? Isn't that the same actress who plays Liz Tan?
Sophie Okonedo. Did she play Liz Tan? I can't remember. I will have to watch The Beast Below again, which is a tragically under-regarded episode, not least by its writer. could well be, but yeah, I mean, another example of the cast... The great cast we got here. I thought I had David Tennant in this, and it turns out I heard David Tennant in this.
It's true. He was playing
Second Night Watchman.
Yes. Sophie Okonedo is a beast. Is Liz Tan? Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So yes, it was. Yeah. So I mean, I thought she was fine in this, but I thought I thought she was very good actually. But the companion was written rather unimaginatively, in the sense of you had a history graduate working as a barmaid, which is a lot less interesting than Rose, which is the obvious comparison, because, you know, we're talking about early noughties reboots of the show, and Rose obviously didn't have any of the advantages of a university education, etc., but did have the smarts, and also did have the PE skills to be able to destroy the Nestine consciousness.
Pluck, that's what we would call it. Pluck.
Yeah, yeah.
So this woman, not only is this companion disinteresting, yeah, she's, for love, she's abandoned having any kind of a thing that she, not that she'd have much of a career with a history major, but okay, you know, she got a degree, and so she sits around at the pub pouring drinks and then watching TV in the evening with her sap of a doctor boyfriend, and disinteresting. She's barely more of a fighter than the rest of the town. I mean, the doctor keeps saying she's a fighter, but I don't see it, really. She doesn't really do anything to impress the doctor, and yet, for some reason, she does. Didn't get that at all.
She certainly... Amongst the town folk.
Yeah, she was the black sheeple as opposed to the rest of them, yeah.
It was more that they were incredibly unimpressive rather than the fact that she was especially impressive. What made her stand out.
I did, in fact, mean that in terms of the phrase black sheep, which is not a reference to the fact that she's a black actress. It was, you know, the one sheep that stands out from the rest. Not that that occurred to me after I said that, but... Just to clarify.
Though interesting, you know, in terms of having a black companion, the scene where everyone she knew and all her friends and presumably her family, I don't know, whatever, everyone else was white.
Well, most of the town folk were kept in shadows. So, I mean, apart from the boss and the fat drunk guy and her boyfriend.
It was interesting in the... In the documentary, when they were talking about the animation, that they were talking about the overall look of the show being quite dark and having lots of scenes where there were silhouettes and things, being as a result of
technical
the requirement,
choice.
A technical choice, so that the animation could be loading in those scenes where there was not much detail, so that it could then play straight away, so it could just stream directly, and you wouldn't have to download any of it. It won a prize, apparently, again, getting it from the documentary, for the best flash animation. I did genuinely think the animation was very impressive in this.
I'm not a fan of flash animation. I've ever since it came out, I've not, I mean, I can see competence in it. Obviously, there's better and there's worse Flash animation, and it's good Flash animation. But there's just something about the way Flash animation works that always will probably perpetually look cheap to me. In the same way that, you know, compare an old-style Disney animated film where every frame is hand-painted and a 1960s or 1970s American Hanna-Barbera cartoon where it's, you know, only parts of the body move at times, or you can clearly see shortcuts are taken in the animation. Flash always looks like a big shortcut to me, and there's something about it. And I know it's, you know, they're still doing the artwork, but I've not yet seen one. Not yet seen a single Flash animation that I'm aware of that I can't instantly tell is a Flash animation. And as long as that's the case, well, there's something
again,
going
the
on.
Answer is in the question there. I think
right.
The thing of...
If there are any, I've never
spotted that there are Flash animations because they didn't look like Flash animations, but that's what you're assuming. That's kind of circular. The point about Flash, I would have said, was that it allows you to take these shortcuts that you're describing. So it lets you do, on a much smaller budget, animation that previously would have been impossible. And that's partly because you have less, you know, there's nothing to stop you keyframing everything and making everything move in every single thing. But because you can just take these shortcuts, then, well, for one thing, that's maybe why you're using Flash. And for another, if you didn't take those shortcuts, then you wouldn't notice that it was Flash. You'd never know.
Well, see, now the question is the Flash animation has also got a... although it has now been used for other things subsequently, it was a web format at that time.
Yes.
It had not moved on to where there are actually animated shows that were made for television that were made with Flash... that still look like they're made with Flash to me, to my eye. But this, you know, so the choice is not just necessarily that they did it for cheap. They did it with the technology that was available for doing web animation. What my question is, when I heard that, and I thought that was fascinating, I mean, technical details actually, like I said, the documentary is far more interesting than the show. The choices that they made with regards to how they would go from one scene to the next scene, or that they would intersperse a wide-angle shot with limited motion or limited detail so that they would use that to buffer a more complicated scene that follows. But we know that the animation was made after the story is recorded, based on the documentary as well. So they've done the audio play, and then they've put it to the animators to do. Were they able to work that within the script, or did they have to change things around? It's like, ooh, you know, we need to do this a little differently. And
you mean, did the script describe the shots?
Yeah.
Or I would imagine not. I don't know, but the animators could use the freedom, because when you have a scene where all you actually have is the audio dialogue being delivered, and you have to create the visual content for that scene. You can establish the scene with a long shot. You can choose to do that as the animator, can't you?
Yes, but I would also imagine that as the animator, you would go through the scenes and you would say, well, you know, this is a scene where I really want to do something dynamic. And this is a scene where I really want to do something dynamic. And this is a scene, hey, he walks into the TARDIS, no big deal. Right? Just wide shot silhouette coming into the TARDIS. I can see the animator doing that for artistic reasons. So you start with there. But what he's saying is that they had to do scenes in a certain order for technical reasons. So,
well,
did they
shots,
ever did they
shots
have,
within right, a scene?
Yeah.
Not,
so
not
did they ever
whole scenes?
Well, I'm an animation scene. I'm thinking not necessarily script scene. But so did they then have to make compromises with regards to which scenes were active or more passive shots? We'll use that term. Or did they somehow manage to get some little rejigging of the story to make it so that it fit that kind of, I need to go soft and then hard and soft and hard with the data rates? I don't know. I would love to sit down and talk with the animators on that. I and I'm not even really a fan of animation in the grand scheme of things, as some people are. Well, you know, some people, like the people who watch anime, Japanese anime all day, because look at the amazing work, and it's fine. But I like animation if I like the story and what's going on, and it doesn't detract.
Yeah, well, I like live action for the same circumstances.
So the artistry of doing all the artwork and stuff is lost on me until it detracts from the story. So that's just me, but I could totally see sitting down with these guys at the animation and just asking questions all day, because it fascinates me when we get into that technical realm where you're having to make the trade-offs between technical and artistic and how they go about it. So
it is interesting that, I mean, they are certainly quite interesting films. You know, that if documentaries about the making of Schalke, there's about 25 minutes on that, and as you say, then there's about 25 minutes on the kind of history of the BBC website, which includes a lot of interesting stuff about Death Comes to Time. And this is on a DVD release for an animated story that managed to it's what, 70 something odd minutes in length. So there's an audience out there going to buy that. There's enough of them to buy it, to fund. I mean, these aren't necessarily high budget documentaries, but they're not, you know, there's a cost attached to making them. So,
but there's also,
are you surprised,
you know, the more...
at all by the fact that Schalke has an audience after all that we've said about it, and after all the reception it had, and the fact that it is this kind of
Delta and the Bannermen is on DVD.
Offshoot. But Delta
Paradise
and the Bannermen
Towers
is
on the DVD.
So,
you know, there is an audience for the completists. You and I own Scream of the Schalke, and neither one of us is crazy about it. It's okay, but, you know, part of the value add of that is those documentaries. They're actually...
But some Doctor Who... some Doctor Who sells more. And also, I don't think I have Delta and the Bannermen yet, but I'd be very willing to get hold of it. I'd be very happy to get hold of it. I can't remember whether it actually has documentary on it, because some of them don't. Some of them are really
woefully deficient.
Well, they're not considered to be big enough sellers, or you know, for some reason it's not seen as, or maybe there isn't enough material to make a documentary about it. But
it's very weird. I mean, even the worst episodes of Doctor Who that I've seen, they can make an interesting documentary out of it, because there's always something that happened when they were making it.
I mean, providing there are still people around who
can talk about it and are willing to and are interesting,
you know, something interesting may have happened, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you can find the subjects who will recount that in an interesting way.
We know there's some correlation, because DVDs are hanging on, or Blu-rays are to some degree hanging on in this age of online streaming, in the fact that they have the bonus content. So you get Paradise Towers, and you've got nothing but Paradise Towers, and you go, $9.99, I don't know. I've seen Paradise Towers. I don't actually need to watch it again. I'm not going to buy it. Or, on the other hand, you go, yeah, but there's 60 minutes of behind the scene. Maybe I'll find out why they made these terrible, terrible choices when they made this episode. And you kind of go, I'll buy it for $9.99. But sometimes the BBC goes, well, maybe we don't think this is good enough to waste our time on the documentaries. But I don't know. It seems like they're always a value add for the person who would even consider buying it.
Well, I don't often watch the documentaries. So a lot of the documentaries on DVD disc on Doctor Who DVDs that I own, I will have to admit now, I haven't actually watched them.
At least the main one?
I watch the story, and then I put the disc back on the shelf, and then a while later I get the disc. Now, assuming it's something that I've bought because I actually wanted to have it to rewatch, I'll get it down again and I'll watch the story and put it back on the shelf without watching the DVD documentary. Occasionally, if there's something I want to know about the story, I will watch the documentary. Some of the documentaries are better than others.
Yes.
Generally, they're of very high quality, but it's about what interests you, and I don't always want to watch them.
See, now,
however, I do kind of appreciate the fact that, and you know I hate this whole idea of canon, but that there are people who would like to know more about how the TV show that is their favourite TV show that they've collected all the stories from was made, and so these behind-the-scenes things interest them. Scream of the Shaokol was made not by the people who made the TV show, but by a bunch of people who worked for the web division of the BBC in a period when Doctor Who wasn't actually being made. And you have two 25-minute, you know, so substantial documentaries interviewing these people about Scream of Shaokol and the other webcasts. And so it just surprised me a bit that it was going to be seen as something that would shift enough copies to justify that. But
well, now I own a copy, but I will say I have not considered purchasing them prior to the point where we were going to do it for Fusion Patrol. It's like I can walk away from those and not do it. So
okay, so I've got a point then, because we said we would do all of the animated stories. That's the reason.
That's it.
Okay. So, yeah.
To be fair, you know, in the case of, like, Death Comes to Time, I have no options. The only way I can see it is to watch it on YouTube, which, you know, technically is sort of a pirated version. There just is no option for me to watch it in any other way that I could find. But again, that
surprised me that you have Scream of the Shaokol, which is seen as being, I mean, obviously you've got the much higher quality production in terms of the animation and everything, but it's seen as being enough of an entry of interest in the history of the show, if not in its canon, to be worth making all these documentaries about and sticking it on a proper release. But you have Real Time and Shada with their sort of animation and extremely good audio soundtrack stuff that aren't worth, and indeed Death Comes to Time, that are not worth putting out in any visual form whatsoever. And in the case of Death Comes to Time, it's no longer even available on audio. It that surprises me too. Why? What is it about Shaokol
resolution
that makes it such an object of being much more interesting to fans, or being much more a commercially viable proposition?
I think it's resolution. I think it's screen resolution. Death Comes to Shaokol is clearly
it's not resolution, because obviously the other things exist in high resolution, but low frame rates.
Do they?
Yeah. There's good quality, but it's the motion that is the limiting factor.
Well, they could have thrown those as a extra on, you know, this.
Shada, in fact, is on the DVD of Shada. So I suppose
that's true.
I'm kind of stretching a point by saying it hasn't had a proper commercial release, but they did kind of shove it on the DVD-ROM bit of the disc as an extra,
which is a pain. Yeah.
Yeah. and as an extra to a show where actually the thing that they've put out is just a bunch of disjointed clips in effect. Because the
Shada show releases,
doesn't exist.
Which I wouldn't have. I almost didn't purchase that one either. So that was very much on my decision list of like, I didn't fit it. But in any case, well, I will say, just going back to the documentaries on the disc, I do enjoy the documentaries. I feel cheated when there isn't a documentary on the disc. But when you look at the Doctor Who releases, many of them will have, I don't know, four or five or six things. There's usually a main documentary, then maybe there's some sort of thematic documentary like Female Companions. And then they really get into the cheap stuff, like stuff on the location footage. I'll always watch the main documentary after I've watched the show. Again, so I remind myself of the show, then I watch the main documentary. The other stuff, it's going to have to catch my eye, or I'm going to have to be really bored before I watch most of the others. And then I never, in fact, I have hundreds of DVDs here, and I have probably only listened to audio commentary on two of them. I just don't do audio commentaries. And I know that's very popular. And so I still have all the audio commentaries on all the Doctor Who's to watch. And the reason I don't watch those is because I want to watch the show without being interrupted. So I've watched it. Then I don't want to watch it again. It's just that simple. And when I'm ready to watch
it. This is all a question of taste, you know. I don't listen to the audio commentaries, and I think it's fine. You know, I'm very happy for people who like the audio commentaries to have them, just as the people who like the documentaries can have them. By the way, was there audio commentary on Schalke? I didn't look.
I don't know. I don't think so.
That would have surprised me. But
I noticed they didn't get Richard E. Grant or Derek Jacobi to do any talking about it in anything that I saw. But
perhaps the documentaries, although they had a budget to do, as I say, 2 25-minute documentaries, it wasn't that.
We couldn't get a presenter. We actually had one of the people who worked on it as the announcer.
Yeah.
He did a good job.
I mean, I do, as I say, I think the documentary is a very impressive quality. If the subject matter interested me more, then I would watch them. And there's certainly nothing nothing in the presentation to put me off. And on the contrary, I think often the presentation actually can make what may be... a slightly thin subject live a bit more.
So it'll be interesting to see what the next batch of animations bonus features are, if anything.
Indeed, but we will certainly be coming to a much more interesting, more interesting. It's all interesting in its own way, even if it's not always successful in its own way, but it's an interesting new chapter in the animations
saga, the Doctor Who animation saga.
Yes, so. Albeit the same animation company. Bit of a spoiler there for the next of our Fusion Patrol Doctor Who animation episodes.
So, if you got anything else about the Richard E. Grant cul-de-sac of Ninth Doctor,
I think I've covered everything. Pretty much. I mean, I noted some of the parallels with the 2005 revival, which we've commented on, like the fact there was a new Doctor, obviously, and the fact that he did get this kind of emotional journey, supposedly, from being an island to, you know, being joined by a companion. And also, I mean, you compared him to Matt Smith doing the wacky stuff. He was a much more modern Doctor.
He definitely did the show tunes.
Than any of the predecessors. In fact, more so than Christopher Eccleston, I think. It was until you got David Tennant that you got some of that kind of excitableness that I think Richard E. Grant does quite well in this, particularly when he starts singing. There were kind of tones in the new show, but an awful lot of choices in it that really just undermined what they were trying to do and kind of guaranteed that it would be filed on the shelf of aborted timelines.
So there is one actually other thing I want to mention. So this show was started in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
That's when they said they started work on it, when they wanted to, after the success of the other things, and they wanted to, you know, hey, 40th anniversary, we're a bunch of Doctor Who nerds, we want to see something for the 40th anniversary, and, you know, through reams and reams of people at the BBC, are you going to do anything with it? Is it, you know, is Doctor Who? And the answer universally coming across the board here is no, Doctor Who's not coming back. We're done. Doctor's, you know, so run with it. Go. And somewhere in 2003, as their production disaster, it's all I can say is the whole thing was just a disaster from one end to the other. You know, at every turn, things just went wrong. And halfway through, they get the word that, oh, yeah, no, actually, we are bringing Doctor Who back. And, you know, you're effectively now in the wilderness already. They're already in the cul-de-sac of time before the show ever comes out. So here's my question. Did the BBC know that? And
the BBC
and kept it a secret even in advance? Because I get the impression
the BBC is an enormous organization. It's not a monolith.
Yes, but
I mean, when you watch the documentary, you actually get a sense of the number of different people they had to go and talk to, in the department that's responsible for commercial exploitation of BBC intellectual property, in the Department of Rights, etc., etc.
Do they actually call it obviously, the Department of Commercial Exploitation? Because I love that.
It's called BBC Worldwide. It used to be called BBC Enterprises in the 1980s, and then it became BBC Worldwide in the 1990s. And its import is because it has to be kept separate from the part of the organisation that makes stuff, because that's the bit that's funded by the licence fee. But I'm getting in.
Right.
Off on a tangent, BBC Worldwide ploughs money back in order to subsidise the licence fee. But obviously the other people they need to talk to are the people in television who might be making the show, but even within television itself, you've obviously got various different people, because the channel who might commission it, you've got the division, because Doctor Who ended up being made by BBC Wales. And, you know, and what you've got here is a bunch of people who with the connection to the web team, who want to make Doctor Who. So they're saying, we want to make Doctor Who, let's do this project for the web, and then we go around and talk to all these people. That doesn't preclude the possibility that there wasn't some other bunch of people in another part of the BBC saying, we want to bring Doctor Who back for the television.
But they named some of the people like Julie Trantor.
Julie Trantor was brought in as producer. It was Lorraine Heggersey, who was the controller of BBC One, so pretty high up, who was kind of instrumental in actually making the decision to bring it back. And of course, we now know that it then again almost got nixed when Mark Thompson came in as the director general. So you've got the real people high up in the BBC who may not know a lot about the show, but may have an idea that what they want is some big family high ratings drama for early Saturday evenings, and possibly this Doctor Who thing that they've heard about might fit the bill. And oh look, they've got one of television's very, very hot properties in terms of show writers who's expressed their interest in writing for it, so why don't we have a conversation with Russell T. Davies? If they had a conversation then, is that necessarily something that any other individual bit of the BBC, the rights department, the Department for Commercial Exploitation or whatever, would necessarily know about? Well, how would they?
I don't know. I think
you would be completely off beam if you were attributing some kind of conspiracy.
No, not necessarily conspiracy.
Where some part of the BBC allowed the web team to go ahead and make this thing, knowing from the outset that they would end up in this cul-de-sac.
Not what I was getting at. At some point, obviously, the BBC team decided to let them in. No. Along the way. So therefore, at some point prior to that, there are people at the BBC who knew. The question I had at hand was, is the BBC so big and non-monolithic that you have all these departments, some of which are actually contemplating Doctor Who, but because it's a secret and they can't tell anybody that they're contemplating, when Cosgrove Hall, or not Cosgrove Hall, but BBC I comes to them and says, hey, BBC, they have to sit there and go, no, we're not planning on bringing Doctor Who back, no. No, not at all, because they can't tell them.
I think that would be a conspiracy. In the documentary, you get the sense that the two parts of the BBC who in fact had an interest in Doctor Who, by the time they found out about one another, they had actually been putting stuff out in the public domain in an effort to communicate with one another, because they were just on completely different levels. So you have this guy in BBC I who's noticing that the controller of BBC One is making speeches about how, well, actually she would like to bring Doctor Who back, but there are rights issues with it. And he pays attention to that, because that doesn't say they're planning to bring Doctor Who back. it's not alarming in that sense, but it's alarming in the sense of, well, if there are rights issues about it, hang on a minute, we're bringing Doctor Who back. Shouldn't we know about what these rights issues are? And it's not until that they publish a news article, because they're the web team. They don't have access to the controller of BBC One, but they're the web team. They publish an article saying, this is a history of the rights issues, this is the situation such as it is. And when it goes public, that's when the controller of BBC One gets her lawyers around her and summons him over to explain it all. At that point, he finds out. But that's not to say that 6 months earlier, there was a plan to bring Doctor Who back anyway. So I don't think there's anything there to say. And I mean, I don't know, because we might find out later, how much would you trust people's accounts anyway? But I don't think there's anything there to say that BBC sat on its hands at any point knowing that it was going to bring something back.
See, I see that as the gross unwieldiness of having multiple departments as being a possibility that, you know, somebody's just like BBC I then had to play this is a secret and I can't tell anybody for time. But anyway, it doesn't really matter.
They're a victim of then the publicity management, the thing that they did for Schalke so badly. But if you do it well, what you want to do is you want to create a buzz about the show, and the way to do that is through a controlled announcement. It's not to kind of give an ongoing commentary of, well, I'm thinking about bringing this show back, or, you know, because these are commercial decisions and there are obviously sensitivities around that. The problem is that by being sensitive and keeping things secret, bits of the organisation don't find out about what other bits are doing.
But what if we didn't say this, I'll finish it off here, if we didn't say this, this was actually conceived. Schalke was conceived as the beginning of a new series of Doctor Who when they went for it. So this has been the success of the shows we've talked about previously, Death Comes to Time. How that was a success, I don't understand. Real Time and Shada have continued them along this aggressive, ambitious path to make ongoing Doctor Who, or at least a year's series, in much the same way that 2005, and was derailed by this other Doctor Who parallel, which I'm happy
they never had the money, but
that's what they were told they needed to do to get the publicity machine behind it from the BBC, and then that slowly got whittled away with money. If I were making a conspiracy statement, I would say that the BBC was making sure they didn't get the money because they didn't want them to have a competing series. But no. Anyway, but that was how they conceived it. I mean, we've been talking about the progression of the animation. It's not just the animation; it's the progression of what they have attempted to do as an ambitious foray into the web. So there is that facet of this too, that this is the new frontier that they're trying to explore new and different things on. And
well,
we're going to give
that
a short shift. But
that is true in the sense that, you know, in our previous three discussions and this one, we have been talking about a kind of progression that, in a sense, comes to an end now. It's not the last Doctor Who animation that will go out on the web, but it's the last one that will go out solely on the web. I think it's fair to say, yes.
Yeah, I think it's that.
And it's no longer the case that the web is the kind of exciting frontier, because within a few years you have iPlayer and all the kind of standard output that goes out on the broadcast television comes over the web as well, and so actually having a webcast of something isn't that special, and animation goes back to being just a format that you can use, but that could be on DVD or on broadcast television as well as being online.
Yeah. Well, next time we're going to be looking, as previously alluded to, a new frontier, and this is the very first recreation of lost episodes of Doctor Who in animated form in the Patrick Troughton story, The Invasion.
unless you count Sharda as recreating a lost story, which it was in a sense. This is the lost visuals. This is recreating the lost visuals to something we have in audio.
Yeah, what we generally call the famous lost stories. Sharda was never lost. It was never finished. That's different from what
it was lost in the sense of
the great BBC
being taken from us. It was something we never got,
but
yes, lost to us, I suppose, is what I'm thinking there, as opposed to being lost,
wiped,
like you lose
lost,
something down the back
presumed
of the sofa,
wiped. So
or lost at sea.
Have we lost any Doctor Who episodes at sea?
Well, no, we haven't lost Doctor Who episodes at sea, but one can lose things
we
at
have
sea.
Actually
ships,
lost an
episode. And that kind of thing.
That whole ship that guy found when he found Web of Fear and Enemy of the World, he put them all on a ship, a container cargo, and it never made it. And that's why they haven't released that information that he found them all yet, because they're at the bottom of the ocean at the moment.
You mean he lost them again?
Yeah. Yeah, he found them and then lost
that's
them.
That's the best conspiracy. That's the best Doctor Who lost episode conspiracy I've heard ever.
Well, thank you for joining me, Simon.
It's been a pleasure, as always.
And listeners, I hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Search for Fusion Patrol. Or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolfe.